Please help me welcome Tom F. His home group is Harbor City Speakers Group.
Good-looking group, isn't it, for a bunch of drunks? Whoa! What happened to the lights?
Blackout.
Hey, look, you can't hide from me, Christ. I'm Tom, I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be anywhere in an upright position. Man. I used to have to wake up in places and had to buy a newspaper to find out where it was. It's true. Most hotels have a nice new, used to have anyway. Yeah. But, now, I am not a problem drinker. I feel sorry for people that go into bars at $5 a shot and buy a piece of problem. I am not a problem drinker. I am what they call an answer drinker. Answer drinker. See, life was a problem, and alcohol would make me postpone feeling any pain, which made alcohol an answer. See, so that makes me an answer drinker. It's very simple. I know I had to do something important today. I knew I wasn't going to get to it, so I'd have a drink and think about it. And it still bothered me I didn't finish that job. I better do some in-depth thinking, so I had another drink. And after doing some in-depth thinking, I decided I would probably be really do a better job tomorrow. And then I would have another drink to celebrate my decision. I did things that way. My mind ran that way. And in this room, I suspect I am not alone. Something very similar. And that's how we really are. And that's one of the greatest powers of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been with you guys since August 14, 1980. And I am more in awe of Alcoholics Anonymous and its members. I'm not in awe of what you like to call the service jobs in AA, what we call service jobs. You know, I'm not in awe of that, but I'm in awe of you guys and you gals in the trenches. You're the ones that amaze me. In the trenches, I mean the girl or the guy that knows they're not qualified to help this girl or guy, but they go anyway. You know the reason they go? They trust God. How do you know? Because that's the reason I go. Very simple. Extremely simple. Well, I'll say this for you guys. Because of good sponsorship and a fine example, my years of sobriety have been an adventure. It's been an adventure for me. Now, I've been blessed with a few marbles loose, in my head. It's enough I can shake a little bit and I can get amused. In fact, I was in a nut house. You probably knew that. And I was in there because I was a nut. I came to in there. I didn't volunteer to do any of this stuff. I came to and I'll tell you the story. Anyway, I've had a good time with you guys. In fact, I have a kind of a disposition. I could have a good time in a telephone booth by myself if the wires are cut. So I don't have a lot of conditions on life. You know, people say, oh, it's cold. Yeah, put on a coat. You know? Oh, Tommy's hot. Take the damn coat off, for Christ's sake. You know? Oh, it's raining. Pick up an umbrella. Oh, it's sunny. Here's some suntan lotion. What do you got all these problems for? This day, like all days, is a good day if we but know what to do with it. And in AA, as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that can move a guy like me from sobriety to recovery, where the answer is, you know. I have a lot of good days. You know, I smile a lot about a lot of things. Hell, I still drive past the cemetery and I feel like a no-show. You know. Now, how can a guy who feels like he belongs dead have a bad day? It's a bonus, ain't it? I used up all my time. And so do a lot of you guys and girls in this room have used up all your time. You are here by the grace of something other than your own decision. And so am I. So it's a bonus when I come to recognize it that way. God has given me everything. And people, how you doing, Tom? I thank God for mercy. To hell with justice. If I got justice, I think I'd be eligible for parole in about 8 months. Yeah. A 1 in 9 kids, Irish Catholic family, born in an industrial part of Baltimore City, white marble steps and all that stuff. You know, I was about 8 blocks from Bethlehem Steel's shipbuilding facility, and we could walk over and see big steam locomotives that belonged to Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, you know, and I could also see some of the manufacturing of from Glenville Martins. So I was in a neighborhood that was really interesting. It had big, strong stuff. And I see these kids today, they're going to go, oh, we're going to go to the mall. Oh, Plasticville. Yeah. I saw some exciting stuff. Man, I seen the wheels of a locomotive this high go past me when I was 8 years old. I just want to see how close I could get to without getting crushed. We're that way, you know. You all know that. See, that's why I talk to you. I don't have to explain nothing. You know exactly what I mean. Because that's how we are, that's all. The wheels are this high, and you're 8 years old, and it's in the bed of a street. And the sidewalk is shaking from the power of this locomotive. It was the Royal Blue. It used to pull the morning congressional up from Washington to New York. But I lived near the roundhouse where I used to wash it. It'd come out of there and the sun be shining. You wouldn't want it to be wet, you know. And it was real dark blue. And it was like the most beautiful thing I ever saw. Until I met this girl I married, and then she had them blue eyes. That it was she was a little stronger than the morning congressional. And anyway, that's another story. The neighborhood was a good neighborhood. It was fun. Bunch of Irish kids and German kids. And we had black kids in those days, you know, and you didn't have to do anything. You either could play second base, and we didn't give a shit what color you were, or you couldn't. That was it. See? And we didn't have anybody to advise us on what we could say. I think they were advising the people that put us in their current national financial condition, the same kind. You know? They know a lot of stuff. They know an awful lot of stuff. But most of the stuff they know is wrong. So it's just wrong. They never spent a day on the firing line. We call that experience. AA loves the word. They say action is the magic word. Okay. So that's what I'm going to talk with you about, and whatever else comes up, it's up, you know. I one time I was talking over in Delaware. They must have been hard-pressed for a speaker or something. I don't know what it was. And I got finished. There was about 1,100 people there. My sponsor was there, and I didn't know he was there. And he showed up. He patted me on the back. He says, "Tom, you did a good job." And I felt very important. My sponsor said, "I did a good job, man. Better get me a press agent or something, you know what I mean? I'm going to get famous." And he said that sponsor thing. You know the illogical stuff the sponsors always say, that you wonder, they come out of left field, where do you get these guys from? He said, "You used to deliver newspapers in South Palmer as a boy, didn't you, Tom?" I said, "Yeah, Wally, what's that got to do with the great talk I just gave?" He says, "That's what I want to talk to you about." He says, "What you really are, Tom, you're the messenger boy, see? God's the editor, and you're the paper boy. Keep that straight, Tom." So if I see you and say, "Paper lady," you know what it's all about, okay? It's that simple. I'm just the delivery boy. I only have opinions. I do not claim to be right on a single thing, including my own name. I'm not right on that. I just have opinions. Now, as we grow in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's a very nice thing to have. You see, when it's time to change, as you grow spiritually, emotionally, and in other ways, as you grow, we have to change, right? But if you're right, it's hard to change. Man, you've got that card and marble. Whoa, hard to change. But if you just have an opinion, I just write it in the sand. And when it's time to change, you just pray for high tide. It's real simple. What I'm saying to you, if you insist on being right, you're going to have a hard time. If you need right in your life, turn to your higher power, your sponsor. What I'm saying is, if you just have an opinion, it's like, and you got to change it, it's like giving away a neighbor's child. But if you're right, it's like giving away your own child. It's a lot harder. Because you're right, that's in you, it's your child, you gave birth to that idea, and you never, ever, ever. So, what I'm going to talk with you about is just my opinion. That's all. If I talk to you 30 days from now, I hope it has changed a bit. That way I would know I'm still growing spiritually by change. The only thing I notice is permanent, and people don't change, is like people laying in caskets, you know what I mean? They're laid back and cool, but I'm not willing to go to that lane. You know, so you have that experience. 1 of 9 kids. Father worked for the post office. He didn't own any guns, so he didn't get any shootouts or nothing. And we all went to parochial school. And everybody worked, and girls worked too. We had 7 boys and 2 girls. My sister's going to celebrate her 50th anniversary in June as a nun. 50 years she's been a nun. She's the world's leading expert on the Montessori system of education. Yeah. She's got a doctor's degree. She taught at McGill up in Montreal, which is a very good college. You know. But she'd rather work with drugs, and she's not an alcoholic. That's the kind of background she has. She'd rather work in the kitchen with new nuns than from a doctor's position that she had. You know, she's something else. I really like her. I liked her when she was a snot-nosed kid. I liked her then, you know. We meet once a year, she and I. I had to go to Paris 1 year to meet her. Yeah. She's crazy. She's going to go to Israel and Jordan. She's telling me about it. This way she talks. She's very educated. Girl. Yeah, Tom, I'm going to go over there and look around in the Holy Land, you know, for my anniversary, you know, as soon as the bombing stops. What a way. What a condition she described. But that's where she is. She had a tremendous impact. Well, I'll get to that. And she still does. And she impacts the lives of a lot of people. And she stays anonymous. That's what I like about her. I really like that. She always was that way. Well, anyway, got an academic scholarship at Johns Hopkins University. I thought it was because I was smart. It wasn't true. After I got sober, I find out it's because I was excessive. I wasn't smart. I was a little above average, but not a whole lot. Not enough to give you a nosebleed. And got drafted. I didn't get my diploma until 3 years after the Korean War. I was in ROTC, and they grabbed up all these guys who are just about ready to graduate because they needed some meat for the grinder. And boom, that was us. And I didn't like that, but the country told me to go, and I went. I was 19, and I was 20. Indestructible. Well, there's some guys over there that liked rice. Thought I was destructible. Yeah. Anyway. And I had some guts, and two older men were attracted to some of the stuff that I knew and was willing to do. And I formed a company with two older men February 4th, 1952 something like that. And it was a very successful company. And again, it was because I was, whatever it took, it took. I didn't care what it took. It takes 40 hours, 50, 60, 80. What's the any? I'm excessive. Whatever it takes, it takes. Made a lot of money. I didn't want to kneel down and go to church when I was a kid with my class, go to communion, because it had holes in my Sunday shoes. My weekday shoes were, you know, not really good. And I decided, yeah, with 9 kids, you know, make some money. So I made a lot of money. Married a girl who was, she was one of those women who grew more beautiful the longer you knew her. But I met women like that, and she was one of those. And I was married to her for 25 years. She was loyal. She was very easy on the eyes. She had a beautiful speaking voice. She had a certain calmness about her, you know. And I really loved her, but I didn't know how to treat her when I got involved in this money book BS, you know. I knew about singleness of purpose, but I didn't include her. I was young. I didn't know. And I had a lot of guilt. You know how I really felt about that? We got divorced. We later became pen pals. She would send me a bill. I'd send her a check. But we were friends. I thought, oh, she's going to be devastated. We're married 20, you know, and because I made a lot of money. She didn't have to work outside the house, and she didn't, but she did a lot of stuff in the house, and she did a lot of service work for people. And she just had that kind of a heart. You know? And how I really felt when I let her down, really, I felt like I betrayed her. That's exactly how I felt. A quality person who loved me, I felt like I betrayed her. Boy, it was a horrible feeling. I'll tell you about that in a few minutes. And I'll just put it real short. I got to you guys August 14, 1980 because of some direct hits in my life. A near miss don't do anything for me. A bullet could whiz past my ear, and I've had that, you know. And as long as it don't hit me in the head, I will admire the hum. What was that, Tom? C sharp. I go back and get the flint out of the brick wall. Sometimes he hit me in the back of the neck. You ever have a bitch like that? Yeah. I got hit too long much in the back of the neck, I suspect, you know. Well, I was divorced from a good woman I was married to for 25 years. That was a direct hit, see. I didn't do trial separation and all that other BS stuff, you know. And I'll just tell you guys some stuff. You get a girl like that in your life, some of you younger guys, pay attention to her. And listen very carefully, because girls like that don't use volume. They're much more subtle. And they get it accomplished too, they know how to do it. And she used to ask me questions when I got home at night at an hour that she thought was unreasonable. I did what she did. And she's there one day with a pan in her hand, a copper pan, and I'm sitting in a chair in here. And she would ask me 5 or 6 questions in a row without waiting for an answer. And to me, it sounded like a machine gun. And she's standing there, and there was 8 questions she asked this night. I would count the questions. And she's going like this. I said, "Joycelyn, 8 questions you asked me. Here's the answers. 4 yeses, 3 noes, 1 maybe, and arrange it in any order you want." Never do that to a quiet woman. Never. I'm sitting. She's got this pinion away from me because, you know, I thought, well, it's some distance between me and her. I forgot she's left in. I forgot a second thing. She was all Maryland first base. She actually forgot the third thing. She batted 600. That means she generally hits what she swings at. She swung at me, hit me on the top of the head, and I saw a burst of red and all black. She knocked me out cold. So when they have their soft voices and they're nice like that, don't ignore that. That's not a sign that they're overly tolerant. That's how she was. It was just like I said. I was divorced. The company I helped found, I got fired from that company in my 29th year, and I own 30% of it. They can't do that, Tom. Yes, they can. How do you know that, Tom? They did it to me. Oh. So, fire. Huh? Made a ton of money. You couldn't drink up the money I made. But I got arrogant. See, I told you I was excessive on the way up. I was like a shark. I didn't deal with individuals. I didn't want to do all that, you know, Kleenex shit or stuff. I dealt only with corporations and companies. I liked that because of freewheeling. Anything went. That's what I liked. Anything goes. You know. And, I mean, I was just as well as they were. It was even. You know. And I was a shark, but I did my homework. I studied these particular subjects every day, 7 days a week, you know, for like 10, 12 years. And I got arrogant at all this money I made. And I got lazy. And I thought it was me instead of the people who helped me, the people who trained me. I thought it was me. And I got careless. The best way I could tell it to you, I went broke. And I'll tell you how I went broke. On the way up, I was a shark. And on the way down, I was bait. That's exactly what happened. I went from living in a neighborhood where athletes lived and all that kind of stuff, you know. John Unitas, some of you may have heard of him, was an outstanding quarterback. Well, I knew him and his wife knew we lived in that neighborhood. Dorothy, his wife, was something else too. She was like my wife. She was a whiz. Anyway, I went there, my next address was under the last bridge you cross over before you go into historic Fort McHenry where the Star Spangled Banner was written. I lived there under a damn bridge from October, which was the 10th month, until about May. Once in a while, I work with some a lot of times. They come up, oh, Tom, it's really hard in this. What's so hard? Well, it's August, Tom, it's hot. And the air conditioning in our halfway house is broken. Oh, here's some Kleenex. Go blow your bastard out. I live under a bridge and he's worried about some air conditioning. Little whiz. And anyway, so I'm living under a bridge. And I come to this great big old room. And they had like patio glass doors as wide as that. And there's a big person standing there and they're silhouetted by the outside light, of course. Like you couldn't make out their face, but this was a big person. I mean, big. 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 All the way around, big. Person got close to me. It was a woman person. I said, my God, she could play for the Eagles. Linebacker. Big. Come up close. What's your problem, Buster? Who the hell you calling Buster? I called her Mr. Nurse. She didn't have any tattoos, though. I was amazed. That I could see. I mean, yeah. Well, some girls have surprised me that had tattoos. How'd you get a tattoo there? You know, I mean, girls are imaginative, you know. The one girl said she went had no imagination. She said she just flunked geography. But anyway, what's your problem? So I went on to tell Mr. Nurse. I told her that there was no knob on my side of the door. I thought it was an architectural oversight, you know, and I wanted to call it to her attention. And Mr. Nurse didn't think so. She did not think it was orchid. She says, you are in a major hospital, and the wing that you are in is the nut wing. And you are here because you are nuts. Well, I didn't agree with it, but it certainly was clear, you know. And her attitude and her size, she was much bigger than me. It didn't seem like the matter was open for discussion. So there I wound up, ex-big shot, you know, in his in a nut ward, just nuts and knobless in a big butt ward. That's where I wound up. So these are things I call a direct hit, wouldn't you? Yeah, she didn't even talk about the child within or nothing. She got right to the point and said, you're nuts. What are you going to say? So I'll put it to you. When I got to you guys, I was divorced. I was fired. I was broke. And I was nuts. Even worse, that's this outside stuff, and you know it. With the woman I cared about and respected, and still do. Yeah, we got married in 1953. How long is that? Would have been 55 years, wouldn't it? Ooh. You're an old bastard, you know that? Well, I follow my sponsors. He said, for me, you just have two words to watch, Tom. No dust, no rust. That's it. No dust, no rust. So, anyway. It's long past arguments and stuff like that, and she was not an argumental type person. What really blew me apart. I look into her eyes and they were just mist over. And nothing was said. But the sound in my ears was real loud. How could you? and the dagger of guilt already in my heart gave such a violent twist I was paralyzed. Didn't know what to say or do. Not just only sprayed me in cement and I'm locked like that. And in total desperation, I made a promise to a God I didn't believe in or trust. And I broke that one too. So the promise I had broken and the vow to this woman is the measure of my guilt. And the promise that I had broken to God is the measure of my shame. And you ladies know a little bit more about that shame than some guys say. It's the inside version of guilting. Well, I got it too. So when I came to you guys, that's the kind of shape I was in. The horse fired, broke, nuts, crushed by guilt, shredded by shame, laid on the sidewalk of life and a roll off into the gutter. When I came to you guys, I was willing to turn my will and my life over to Ronald McDonald. That's the kind of shape I was in. I didn't come to order to you know philosophy or psychology or, you know, nothing. I had the wonderful gift of total desperation. If I could wish to anybody who's having a hard time in recovery, I would wish you the gift of desperation. Desperation, I think, you know, is the father of recovery. Desperation is. Most think inspiration might do it. That's okay. I don't, and Mr. Edison didn't either. He said perspiration, I believe. When you're desperate enough, you'll do it. You will take actions you don't believe in. If you're desperate enough. If you're not desperate enough, you will join an in-depth study group. Oh, ain't that funny? Yeah. I know you're going to rewrite the big book. You're so smart. Action is the magic word. You can read that book and you will find some unusual phrases. But let me tell you something. You'll find some excitement in the book. You'll be rocketed into the fourth dimension, the existence of which we never even dreamed, right? That's in this book. What nerve do you have to come in here and say you're hanging in there when they got a rocket ship parked by the door? What do you want, an ox cart? It's a rocket ship there. What are you limiting this program so much for? By your intellect, how you think it should work? I tried that before you. I was wrong. If you're still doing it, you're still wrong. Very simple. What do? Do the steps. How can I do the steps without studying them? Get a sponsor who has done the steps and follow your sponsor. It's real simple. You know? If you're lost and you can't read a road map and you want to go to Pittsburgh, find the girl in the hot dog joint or something who's going home and she's living in Pittsburgh and follow her. You need no map. It's so simple. How do you recover? Find somebody in AA who has what you want. That's what you do. Now, of course, the intellectuals come to us. Oh, I would like to find somebody I can relate to. Well, we're a little short on assholes this week. I think we'll send you over to Tom. Find somebody you relate to, get out of the bar. They're not done using you yet. Find somebody who has what you want. Why would you want to do it that way? Because it works. That's the reason. It really works. And it works quickly. There's nothing to study. If you find a woman who has what you want, and you follow her and do what she does, you will get what she has. And that's what you wanted. It's so simple that we can't accept that. Oh, much more complicated than that. No, you're not. Your head's complicated. That's all. That's all. That's what you do. And you get the action. I told you about the words in the book, but let me tell you something a little bit different. After you read the words and you're impressed by the spiritual depth of the words, follow the direction of those words and you will find the result compared to the words is absolutely magnificent. That's what I find. You can find all the beauty in the structure of the words. God will remove the problem. I come in with a shovel like I'm going to do something with it. God removes the problem. What should I do with a shovel? Don't tempt me. And that's what we do. I don't want to get close to God. You don't know some of the stuff I've done. I come from an industrial neighborhood, and between the ages of 25 and 35, I would run around in the 60s. In the 60s. With about $15,000 to $20,000 worth of cash in the trunk of my car in case I wanted to go somewhere and not leave a paper trail. Now, do you think a guy who lived like that for 10 years, like a wild man, would come in here and stay 29 years if this was dull? You better re-examine that. Hey, it's not dull. It is exciting. I know why I was born, because of your steps. I know what I'm supposed to be doing now, because of your steps. And I have a general idea that when I run out of this shell I call a body, I will be somewhere in God's service 1,000 years from now. I may be a frog or something. I don't care. I guess I have to croak twice to do that, wouldn't I? Yeah. It's exciting. Now, let me tell you what is the neglected, in my opinion, portion of AA. Neglected. What do we hear? That's just why I say it. What do we hear? Some guy will say, oh yeah, it says, looks like they're doing some laying off at my plant. I love it. He laid off. My wife is a little bit sick, and the lawnmower broke, and the goldfish is breathing bubbles again, I've been a little bit off, so I've been going to 3 meetings a day, and I went to a novena and stuff like that. Oh, that's nice. How nice of you. 3 meetings a day. If you think that meetings alone is going to help you grow spiritually, it's like me believing I could go and sit in a garage and become a car. You couldn't get drunk sitting next to a woman drinking and you not drinking, could you? You had a drink. And you won't get sober sitting next to a woman doing the steps unless you participate with her. Does that make sense? It's that simple. But you never hear people say that when their sobriety seems a bit thin and something threatened, you never hear them say what the instructions are. But the instructions I was given was, practical experience has shown that nothing, that means no other thing, Nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with others, not when I can squeeze it into my busy schedule. Intensive work with others. And then because I'm a thickhead, Bill put a PS under that sentence with the next one, which says, this works when other activities fail. Now, that's the direction. Have you ever heard anybody say that in an AA meeting when they come in and are trying to say they're doing something to bolster up their program? They always say meetings. And they never say work with others. Duty. And that's because of poor sponsorship. You don't expect a new person to know that. How would they know? They just got here. But you didn't just get here. I'm 4 weeks sober. My sponsor, Wally, he just celebrated his 45th. Yeah. He's 84. He wanted me to go to Belize last year with him and his wife for 60 years to do some missionary work. That's the kind of people I'm around. He says, I told you, Tom, to get over by that door, get out of the middle of that room, BSing with your friends before this meeting. I told you to get over there and get a new guy. I'm 4 weeks sober, right? I'm writing the fourth step. He said, about the fourth step. You ain't Charles Manson and you ain't William Shakespeare, okay? I don't care about your pity, your picayune pornography crap. He said, it might be interesting to you, but it's boring to me. He said, don't write me a lot of shit I gotta read. He told me the rule between me and him. He said, the rule is this, I'd rather step on your toes than stand on your grave. I understood that. I didn't like it, but boy, it was clear. Just like Mr. Nurse, you know, you're nuts. I didn't like that either, but it was clear. I never struggle for agreement. I'm not selling anything. I struggle for clarity. God gave you a free will. I have no business trying to upstage God. That's the reason we go for attraction. And I told you, when you pick somebody who has what you want. That's what we do. Get over there, Tom. I'm not qualified, Wally. He says, I know that. You know that. But he don't know that. Get over there. What happens when you do something like that following a sponsor? First of all, you're afraid to death you're going to kill him. I was. When you put me, I'm going to kill this poor guy. What happens? Right away, you're in the big book. You haven't been reading a whole lot lately. Been busy, you know. You're in the book because you're afraid of killing him. Now, you can't find the answer in the book, so what are you doing? You're talking to your sponsor, aren't you? We find out where in the book it is, ain't you? Yeah. Okay. Now you can't get a hold of your sponsor. What are you doing? You're on your knees saying, God, you sent me a guy crazier than me. I don't know what to do with him. But my sponsor said he's God's kid too. So you better give me some directions. P.S. I'm alcoholic, you know. So keep a sort of plank. And that's how you pray, see, for this guy, because you don't want to kill it. What I'm saying, that when we work with others, we use every tool, don't we? And we don't even see it that way. But we use every tool that's available because you're learning to love somebody just because he's God's kid. You don't want to kill him or her, and you just met him. You want to help. All of a sudden, you can trust this person, like your sponsor, and you're trusting the person you're sponsoring. Look how much easier it makes when you do it that way to trust God. It breaks you in, doesn't it? To trust. AA is very, very effective. See how it works? Then you have people who come to you. Guys who come to me are like semi-desperate. They have been other places, you know. And that's the kind I get. And they sent me a guy down from Pittsburgh, a guy named, some of you guys might know, Duke Hanna. He's been sober about 60 years. Tough old bastard, you know. My kind of a guy, though. His heart's bigger than he is. And he sends me a guy named Gerard. Gerard is a stone atheist, he thinks. Gerard wrecks motorcycles and all that kind of crap, you know. And he's trying to impress a guy like me who's beyond impression, you know, how tough he is. And Duke Hanna sends him down to me as a threat. So he comes. I says, Duke sent me. I don't like it. But I live in that halfway house that's running up there. Don't you give me that god shit. I'm an atheist. I said, I don't care what you believe. I just know one thing. What you believe has got you talking to an old gray-haired Irish bastard from Baltimore and that you don't like. That's where your belief has got you. So I'm a very fast driver. But he didn't know what I meant. I was going to show him. And I just drive fast, that's all. And I made him sit up front next to me. The other guys, I'm sitting in the back. And I would roll up to Philadelphia, go up to Jersey, or down into Richmond. I'd go to those kind of places, like you go around the corner. You know, that's what I do. And I'm rolling down there. He said, after about 3 weeks of riding with me, he says, oh, damn you, Flynn. I said, what's the matter, honey? He says, you got me praying to be trying some pain. I'm praying in this damn seat and I'm an atheist. I said, honey, didn't I tell you I was a spiritual driver? You know the rumble things you get over on the shoulder of the road? When the music goes boom, 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 you know what I'm talking about? I'm going down there on 83 coming down from, I don't know where, and it's going boom, boom, boom. He's like, damn it, now he's driving my braille. Working with guys, and I work with two women, but none of them, the two women, none of them were new. One was like sober 12 years, and the other, I think, 10. And both are sober over 20 now. The one in Sacramento has changed the quality of recovery in Sacramento. And she goes out there, and she's got like 30 girls. 30. And they show up at her house. And on the summertime, they bring their little kitties and all that. You know. She's changed things. Got another one in Palm Beach. Same thing. She has literally changed. So don't tell me you can't make a change. I've seen these women do it. I've seen it. I didn't read about it. I've seen it. You owe it. You're like me. We'll finish on time for those of you who have a date. Two things I guess I want to share with you. One, how to be totally rid of fear. I found a way in AA to do that. I'll give you the experience. Yeah, we're going to court Monday morning. Oh, yeah. I hope that judge don't find out some of the other shit I did. I hope it's just what they got me charged with. You know. And you're afraid that that some of that may come up. And they gave you a what do you call those lawyers? The public defender? Yeah. Unexperienced public defender. And he'd love to get you electrocuted for something minor. So you need to know that. So, you got all this kind of fear, see? Now, I'll give you a definition of fear. Fear is an emotion. Is that a reasonable statement? Isn't that emotion a reaction to what you were thinking? So you're thinking you're going to go in that courtroom by yourself, don't you? And you're afraid, aren't you? And you think that lawyer is incompetent. Now let me tell you what the truth is. I say that when Flynn thinks that way, his thinking is delusional. He believes it truly, but it's delusional. You know, people say, oh, I'm in denial. You're not in denial. In order to deny something, you got to know the truth, don't you? And say it ain't so. Delusion is something totally different. Okay. Not the same. Delusion is to have a truth that you believe that is really not true. You're not a liar, you're delusional. And your fear is given birth by a delusional thought. So your fear is delusional. What is the truth then? The truth is God is everywhere, including the courtroom. The truth is, whether you know it or not, you're God's kid. I know that you're God's kid. See? I don't care what you know. That's your business. I'm old enough to mind my own business. It's that simple. But I know that God's in that courtroom. I know that the judge is God's kid. I know that the state's attorney is God's kid. That's what I know. Whether they know it or not, it's not my business. It's I know it. I know that God loves me. How do you know it? Working with others. If you had a kid in serious condition that you loved, wouldn't you send somebody to that kid that you liked? So if God sends you after these kids, you know he loves you because he sends you in a tough spot. So you don't have to pray about it. You know it because of the action you take. How do you like that? Yeah, it's that simple. And fear is really the practice of the delusional idea. It's the practice of the absence of God. That's what it is. The practice of the absence of God. The answer to fear, therefore, would be to practice the presence of God. Is that a reasonable statement? It's like when the sun comes up. I don't know where the fear goes. When the sun comes up, where does the darkness go? Do you know for sure? I don't either. But I know it's gone. And when the presence of God is in your heart and felt in your body, fear goes too. I don't know where it goes either. I'm not in pursuit of lost fear. Let me finish with just one thing. The importance of love. I had an opportunity. You heard this woman, Mother Teresa? Yeah. She has a house in Baltimore on Collington Avenue. There's an old nurse who I've known since I was 8 years old. Goes over there and she gives the medication to these people because she's licensed, you know. And but these guys are so weak in the HIV stuff and all. They're very, very weak and they can't even move a box around. So they need somebody pretty dumb to do that kind of stuff, and I was perfect for that job. I can move boxes and all, you don't have to be smart enough. So that's what I did. So she came to town, Teresa did, to Baltimore, to renew the vows of some of her nuns who did their first 2 years as postulants. And So the head nun over there says, you and Virginia, who was the nurse, can come over and talk with Teresa before she does the vows for the nurse. I said, God damn, that's a good shot. Let me go over and talk to her. She's only about that big. I thought, Jesus, how'd she cause all this commotion? I said, okay, Teresa, what's the hardest thing you ever had to do? She didn't bat an eye. She looked back at me and says, recognize God in his most disgusting disguises. Whoa, you're going to hit me across the chest with a baseball bat. It shook me back out of her. She didn't bat an eye. Wham! She was like that. Recognize God in his most disgusting disguises. You don't have to like the person, but you must love her. Must love her. Shit. Now you guys, you're easy to love. You're easy to love because you love one another. You love one another, so you're very easy to love. It sort of radiates among you. And I could feel it in the room. You could feel that little bit of electricity in the room. Okay. That's love. That's the spirit of love. You put a little bit in, you put a little bit in, but you collectively say, and I can feel it. So, I really enjoy you people. You are wonderfully made. You can do wonderful things. I don't think there's anybody exceptional. I think there are those among us, in particular. We can get our ego down low enough that more of God flows through us, not from us, and allows us to do things that are beyond our intelligence. And that's when God uses you. Generally, he uses you to help others. Would you want to hear one more little story?
Yeah.
I want to tell you, you got a special gift that the hospitals would love to have, and the clergy would love to have. Now, the Indians have a custom that they do. After the battles were over, they would take the braves and put them in the long tent, say, with their feet facing each other. And they would treat their wounds with herbs and whatever else they had, you know. And then they would take some old warrior who had been in many battles, see. Now, the poor young warriors are laying out there, they're scared to death. And they think they're not going to recover because they've seen a lot of death in the last 2 days. The old warrior would come in and they put a bright cloak on him, but underneath him he wore nothing. And he walked in and he walked down the middle of these wounded braves. And he'd take off his cloak. And they saw all his wounds. And they saw him walking correctly. All those wounds. And they got hope. They got hope and they started to heal at that point when they saw this old sucker had survived all those wounds and walked erect among them. And that's what you are. You're a wounded healer. When you share all your tribulations, say, you're a wounded healer. And that's why the person who is newly wounded and fearful can get hope from you. That's what you are. You wounded healers have healed me. I try to pay you back. Every time I try to pay you back, I think deeper in your debt. I love you. Thank you.